Gilgo Beach murders involved 11 or more victims that were found in New York between about 2010 and 2011. Rex Harriman was arrested 13 years later, and he's been in prison. He's been charged with the death of 7 of the women who were mostly sex workers. It recently has been announced, and we don't know if this is true, but that he intends to plead guilty next week. And it has everybody in the legal community a little curious about why he would be doing that at this juncture. And with us to just generally discuss serial killers is Dr. Catherine Ramslin, who is a professor of forensic psychology and behavioral criminology at DeSales University. She's authored 73 books, including Confession of a Serial Killer, The Human Predator, The Mind of a Murderer, The Serial Killer's Apprentice. She's appeared as an expert in many cases, and she's been in 250 crime documentaries and podcasts. She's consulted for CSI and Bones, and she's the executive producer of Murder House Flip. Welcome to the show, Catherine. Good to hear and talk to you. Happy Easter to you.
Happy Easter. Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
You have so much knowledge in this area, and I wanted to, before we talk to about Gilgo Beach, I just think just an odd situation is that you had a student who was studying for a PhD in criminology, and by the name of Brian Koberger, who pled guilty last year to the murders of 4 co-eds at University of Iowa in their off-campus home. Did you have any clue that he was a person who was capable of any of that?
There was nothing in his demeanor or any of his work that would have suggested that.
And, you know, I guess that becomes part of the discussion on an ongoing basis when it comes to serial killers and people like this, because of your inability to know what really is behind someone's motivations here. But I guess let's just talk a little bit about the Gilgo Beach killer. From what you know, Professor Ramslin, what do you see? Was he a normal kind of guy, and was he a person who would compartmentalize his good and his bad?
Well, from the reports, he was kind of an awkward guy, and there were people in his neighborhood who thought he had the creepiest house on the block. He was standoffish, but in his work, I mean, he apparently did very well with his work as an architect and getting the deals that he got. So, but he clearly had a dark side, despite living with a wife and kids and having a full-time job. He nevertheless carried on this very dark part of himself, looking for young women, very small young women. That was one of his specifications. He wanted them to be petite young sex workers that he could torture and kill.
And he himself is a very large man.
Very large.
Yes. And, you know, I hear this all the time. His wife must have known, really. I mean, how can you live with somebody and not know they're perpetrating? Tell us what your thoughts are on that.
Well, first of all, the people who live with someone who's doing this are not seeing malignant things in their ordinary behavior. And even if they do see something, they're not jumping to the conclusion, oh, my God, I'm living with a serial killer or rapist or something like that. They're usually putting the most benign spin on anything that they might see that sets them off. Like I remember Dennis Rader's wife noticed that he spelled things like the BTK letters to the newspapers, and he quickly brushed that off as, well, we probably taught the same kind of phonics, probably around the same age, and she accepted that rather than saying, my God, could you possibly be the guy? And I think we find that often with relatives, especially spouses of serial killers, is they will not see behavior, but in retrospect, like the lies that are told or the inconsistencies or hiding certain things or being out of town and being can't find them, they're not where they said they were, things like that, in retrospect will take on more significance. But typically, if the killer is very good at hiding who they are, they can fool people they're living with all the time.
And I am reading one of your books, and I've read a few of them, and I know that, you know, you had extensive interviews with Dennis Rader, the BTK killer, and you spent hours with him and kind of got to know him. And the issue of morality is an interesting one. And as you know, I represented John Gacy in his final death row appeals, mm-hmm. who was guilty of so many heinous crimes. I mean, the worst of the worst. But yet he had a moral code that he would inflict on everyone around him about what was the right way to do things and what was the wrong way to do things and how people should be treated. And some of it was really good stuff. And yet he had this side of him that did horrible things that no one could even imagine. How do you explain that from a psychological standpoint?
Well, actually, I think Rader has a good explanation for that. He did the same thing. We'd watch these TV shows, and he would be outraged over certain things that he saw on TV, and that was fiction. But he had a way of talking about it, and he called it cubing. You know, in psychology, you might call it compartmentalizing, but I think cubing is a better idea, and that is where you think of the person as having multiple sides, like a cube, and every one of those is accessible to them, but some contradict others, and they only use one side for any given situation, like being a good father, for example, and then being a burglar is another side, of being a serial killer, being a minister, so they can sort of pivot to whatever they need to show in a given situation. And they don't have any sense of integrity because they're not deeply rooted in any kind of truth that matters or any sense of identity. They're only out for themselves, and typically they're narcissists, and they're looking for their own advantage. And so they have all these sides accessible to them, and so that would make sense for Gacy, like it did with Rader, that things that he saw that he had a moral code for. And he would, you know, talk about, but it would be different for him because he would frame it differently. It's a life frame, and it looks different for him. I mean, we'll see it in politicians all the time too. It doesn't have to be a killer. We see it all the time with people who say one thing, but they're doing something that completely contradicts it.
Yeah, and I, you know, I am not a psychologist, but, you know, I think that normal people are what I use the word integrated, meaning like, I think if I know somebody and I know them pretty well, like I know what they're going to do in a given situation. Not always, but you know, you kind of know mm-hmm. and can predict how someone's going to react to something that's out of the ordinary. But with a person who is disordered, like the Gacys and the Raiders of the world, you just don't know what you're going to get because, like you said, one day they say one thing and the next day it's something completely different. And yet they think that that's normal for them. I mean, that's just the way they're wired, which.
But even the people we think we know very well, maybe they're having an affair. Maybe they're, like, I just watched a documentary of two 16-year-old girls killing their best friend because they didn't like her. And she would have never seen that come. She didn't see it coming. She thought she could anticipate who they were and what they were going to do, and she didn't. And nobody who knew them could have ever imagined they would consider a plan like that and carry it out.
Well, that makes me feel really good, Professor Renzel. Because, you know, I I've talked about this a lot, and I've been on panels with you. And, you know, it the scary part about Gacy for me was not sitting with him and because I wasn't going to be harmed by him because he had use for me as a manipulator and as a narcissist. Right. But what scared me was how many people do I know who might have a tendency to do anything like this who I have in my life? And I'm just not, mm-hmm. my radar's not up. You know, that to me is frightening.
And I think that is actually adaptive for us, you know, getting sort of the larger picture here. If we were always being suspicious of everyone around us, we wouldn't be able to function as a community. So our inability to see them is actually adaptive in another way for us. And I think that those of us who study these guys have kind of withdrawn from some of those bonds because we see what people do and what they're capable of, and we're probably a little bit more wary. of some of these relationships. But I think ordinarily people are better served to accept and to trust and to see the, you know, to anticipate what they expect to happen than to always be suspicious of people.
I'm also here with Matt Moyer, who's a former prosecutor, and I know he has a question for you, Professor.
Hey, sure. Professor. Yeah, so I've never prosecuted a serial killer, but I'm fascinated by them. I watch all the Netflix documentaries. I'm wondering, from your perspective, to what degree is the serial killer's nature governed by or attributed to some sort of like screw loose in their brain, something genetic or something like that, versus the way that they grow up, maybe some sort of traumatic events that trigger them to have these kind of depraved fixations and desires? Is it something that they're born with, or is it something that develops as they grow up?
That's the number one question I get from everybody, and it's impossible to say. There's no formula for what is nature, what is nurture, and serial killer is not a criminal type. It is a description of a behavior. They have killed at least two people on two separate occasions. So that leaves a lot of range of different types of mentality and different types of people. We have killers as young as 8 and as old as in their 50s, male and female, single, doubles, triple, you know, larger groups. And we have over 5,000 documented, so it's not possible to give any kind of formula or to even talk about them in a generic way as if there's a serial killer in nature, because there isn't. You look at the cases to try to understand what that person did, because for example, John Wayne Gacy is very different from Ted Bundy, who's very different from Jeffrey Dahmer, who's very different from Dennis Rader. And so what they have in common is that they've killed at least two people on two different occasions. And that's the FBI's definition. There are criminologists who say it's got to be 3 or 4 or 5. But if we go with the FBI definition, there's really nothing in there about their nature at all.
And that's frustrating because, you know, that's the question that everyone wants you to answer. When I say you and me too, mm-hmm. because, you know, I can say that Gacy, you know, grew up in a home that was strictly Catholic, and he was probably knowledgeable about being a homosexual and knew that that wasn't going to be a good thing with his dad. And his dad was mean to him and beat him and all of those things. But you see people with those backgrounds from that mm-hmm. time period and who are completely normal. And then you've got Dennis Rader, who was really raised in kind of a nice background, a nice family. We had wholesome church going stuff going on, held a job for a long time. So he didn't have any of those things, right?
And some of them will have what we see in the psychopaths. They have different brain structures. Maybe we don't have any brain scans of Rader. Maybe he's got some of that with a predisposition. But, you know, again, it's not possible to group them all in the same way. I'm not sure really how to answer. We can't answer it. That's what I say. You can't answer that question about them as a group. It's not possible.
So,
and if you want to try, it makes it look as if we could get that formula, we'd be safe. And that's just not true.
And so you're studying this. So then why are you studying it? I mean, you're studying it because we want to know if we can prevent that, or is there a point mm-hmm. in time where a young man is in high school and he's having these thoughts and maybe we can nip it in the bud? I mean, is that still a possibility,
yes.
you think?
Well, one of the factors that people don't really think much about is perception. And perception, so you could have two, three, four, five kids all experience the same abuse, neglect, and so one who perceives it to be traumatic or who thinks something's owed to him or her and gets angry over it and wants to punish somebody versus somebody who takes it in stride versus somebody who's crippled by it. So it's about perception, which is part of this, and that's not really, that's a combination of nature and nurture. So we're looking at what are some of the commonalities in the behavior of kids that could potentially put them on that path. It isn't that we have a set of predictors that are always going to give us the answer. We don't. Like the McDonald triad notion that we have bedwetting, animal cruelty, and fire setting, that's never been proven to be a precursor to people becoming violent, let alone serial killers. So unfortunately, people think that that's a nice, neat formula. It doesn't work for anything. Animal cruelty is a precursor, and it's a particular type of cruelty or extensive fire setting with a callousness. So we're looking for specific things in kids, like callous disregard, for example, where they're cruel to other kids and they just have no sense of remorse or that this is wrong. So that's one of the things, and you combine that with a few other common things that we're seeing. We learn that from studying serial killers and their backgrounds and their trajectories to help with programs for intervention and prediction, but we don't have any kind of formula for it. We just have certain things that they have in common, what we see in those backgrounds that have issued in someone becoming violent and repetitively violent. So then we try to intervene on those things early before they can get to a certain point.
We only have a minute here, but is there a crossover, do you think, with some of these predictors or whatever you're going to call them, with school shooters? The idea of fantasy is, I know, a big part of the serial killer. He has a fantasy, and then he starts acting on it and that type of thing. And you see in the school shooters, you know, in the notes and the things that they've written, that they have a fantasy and that they're enacting that fantasy in executing their school shooting. Is there a crossover?
Yeah. Yeah, fantasy and type. They're actually closer to the mass murderers, which are quite different from serial killers. The mass murderers have a sense of entitlement. They get angry quickly. They're generally rigid. They start making a list of grudges. They collect their wound collectors, and then they start having a fantasy of, how can I take control of this and punish people? So they're actually closer to what we call mass murderers.
Interesting. And I know that you're working on your memoir, and I'm really excited to read the whole thing. And you're going to come back on our show and discuss that when it's published, right?
Yeah.
All right.
Eventually, yeah.
Yes. That's fabulous. Catherine Ramsland, thank you so very much. I would highly recommend you picking up some books. If you're interested in serial killers, you're interested in the mind of a murderer, there's some good books out there. Ramsland, R-A-M-S-L-A-N-D, Confession of a Serial Killer, Human Predator, The Mind of a Murderer. And your most recent one, which we talked about on this show, is The Serial Killer's Apprentice, a very, very interesting book about how killers engage others to help commit the crime, something that is not talked about as much as some of these other topics. But thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk again.